Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how are some of Arizona's federal employees feeling in the third week of the government shutdown?
And should we bring back the Bracero program for Mexican farm workers amid deportations and worker shortages?
But first, vacancy rates for office and retail spaces in the Valley were down in the third quarter of this year, while the amount businesses paid for those spaces was up. Those are among the findings in a new report from commercial real estate firm CBRE. Senior Vice President Dave Barrett is here with me now to talk more about the numbers and what they mean. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So let's start with retail spaces. You found that the vacancy rate was down by about 5% and the rent rate was up by almost $19. That seems pretty significant.
Sure. Yeah. Obviously, we've had a lot of new retail opportunities throughout the valley. You've seen 80 to 100,000 new residents coming into the valley, kind of because of the cost of residential, your opportunities to live in and around, you're kind of having to move to the outskirts areas. So a lot of what we've seen is higher rental rates, lower vacancy rates in those areas, in the both the suburban and the more the areas around. I think you're seeing some improved economics. Improved income levels for the folks that are working here. You're also, I think there was some pent up demand coming out of it in the run up to COVID. Prior to, you saw a lot of the retail owner or a lot of retail groups were trying to shed space, maybe to shrink their footprints.
Hmm.
I think that was the impact of maybe e-commerce.
Okay.
I think then shortly thereafterward, you saw folks obviously wanting to get back into the community after COVID. So, get out and have those experiences. And so I think that encouraged more retailers to open. You saw probably some entrepreneurial nature that came out of that as well, where you had folks that had been sitting, and decided that they wanted to maybe take the risk of being an entrepreneur, opening up, a coffee shop, a flower shop, restaurants, those types of things. So I think a lot of that has driven the vacancy rate down. And in doing that, that's always going to have an impact on the rents.
Right. Supply and demand there.
Right.
So are there particular parts of the valley that are seeing more growth, more retail opening up?
Yeah, I think in the West Valley, Avondale, Goodyear are seeing a tremendous amount because of the residential opportunities that are there. I also think you're seeing it in areas like Apache Junction, where you have some new master plan communities that are going in out there, 5,000-6,000 houses that are being constructed. All of those are having an impact on either anticipatory while the construction is going on, maybe having some, obviously some good opportunities for retailers in those parts of town.
It's the old line, retail follows rooftops, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So let's talk about office space, mm-hmm. Because we saw also that the vacancy rate down by a pretty good amount, almost 22% there, rent up as well there. Is this the same kind of concept, just sort of pent-up demand from maybe even pre-COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. Office activity has increased dramatically. I think you're also slow. You're seeing a significant slow of sublease space coming on the market. You do still have that flight to quality, where users around town were maybe in a couple of 100,000 square feet, trying to shrink their footprint down and moving to something nicer to give a better experience for their employees.
Yeah. And what does all of this say about sort of the state of the valley's economy? Can you take lessons from these numbers?
We think so. Obviously, we think it's all positive. Obviously, the retail rents that's positive. The vacancy rate's going down is positive. The continued influx of people into the valley is very, very positive. The office market really kind of took it on the chin early on because COVID was supposed to be the death of office, right?
Yeah.
And I think the realization that that's not actually the case, that you do need to have a place to come into to work, you're never going to get away from the work from home concept. That's still something that works its way into discussions. It's still something that employers have to plan for. Seems like nationwide they've settled on about a 3-day a week, a work week, being in the office. I think that speaks highly of when you have companies actually making decisions and not pushing them off, that's always a good thing. That means that they can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And so we've taken that as super positive.
Well, so I want to ask you more about sort of the work from home in office issue, because it seems as though there's been sort of a pendulum where, you know, everybody was remote, then everybody's being called back to the office. And now, as you say, a lot of firms have sort of settled on this hybrid model. What does that mean for the kinds of spaces that companies need and the kinds of spaces that are being developed?
For starters, you know, companies are still trying to be efficient in the spaces that they have. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes means that some of the amenities that they would have normally had in their space, now I think the developers are looking at putting that as a shared amenity in the building, so that it is something that they can control the quality of, but then still be able to offer that to a new tenant or a new occupier of the space. I think it's a better environment for the employee, and it's certainly something on their minds when companies go in and begin to look for new space.
So companies are thinking about what the employee experience is like, but maybe not sort of in the foosball, ping pong table, free snacks way.
Yeah, no, not quite that way anymore. Yeah, absolutely. And then I think the developers are looking at it as newer buildings, they're just going ahead and kind of biting the bullet and paying for that to be put into the space. A lot of times, we'll go out with users and they'll eliminate buildings that don't have certain types of amenities. But I also think there's that that concept of, if you're in a smaller footprint, that maybe you don't have space for all of your employees, right? I think employers are a lot of times now planning for more of a one and a half to one seat kind of scenario. But then that also means that they don't typically have if they need to have an all hands meeting or something along those lines, they don't have that in their space. And so developers are coming in and saying, okay, fine, we can solve that problem for you.
Interesting. All right. That is Dave Barrett, Senior Vice President with the commercial real estate firm CBRE. Dave, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
The federal government shutdown is in its third week, and many workers just missed their first paycheck. A federal judge yesterday blocked the Trump administration from laying off workers during the shutdown, and more votes in the U.S. Senate to fund the government failed again. The union representing federal employees estimates there are between 30 and 40,000 workers in Arizona in jobs ranging from TSA to the Social Security Administration, Defense Department, Border Patrol, and Labor Department, among others. Mario Campos is a national vice president for the American Federation of Government Employees, representing District 12, which includes Arizona. I spoke with him yesterday afternoon and asked what he's hearing from his members.
Well, there's definitely lots of uncertainty and fear, to be honest, from them. They don't know when they're going to be paid again. Some of them are furloughed, meaning they're at home and not working, and others that are deemed to be essential workers are still working, but also unsure of when they're going to get paid, when the shutdown is going to end.
Yeah, and you know, obviously, this week is the first week for folks to be missing paychecks. Have you heard anything, you know, from folks about, you know, how they're trying to make do, how they're trying to get by without getting their salaries?
Well, through the union, we're trying to do what we can to assist our members and federal employees in general through these times. We have been working with different organizations such as the AFL-CIO and other unions and also food banks to try to get our members assistance however we can. There's no way that the union could ever take on the responsibility of the government to take care of their workforce.
Yeah, I would imagine that if you're looking to try to help out some of your workers, you could probably do that for some amount of time, but probably not forever, right?
Correct. At the end of the day, it's the responsibility of the federal government to take care of its workforce. And it's the responsibility of our lawmakers to make sure that we have funding for our government to operate.
How would you describe morale among your members?
In general, low. You know, this greatly affects people's mental health and morale. You know, we have some people that are at home, like I said, not working, and others that are forced to continue working without pay. And not only the pay aspect of it, but there's also the service aspect of it. When the government is shut down, lots of the activities that the employees would normally be doing are also shut down, meaning they're not providing service to the community. And so most of the federal employees that I know, that I interact with, provide a service to our country, and they take great pride in that. They take great pride in being able to service the community and those within their communities. And they're just not being allowed to do so right now because the government is shut down. You add the uncertainty of their livelihoods. You know, lots of federal employees also have families. And in lots of these families, they are the breadwinners. They are single income families, and just not knowing when they're going to get paid again and how they're going to pay the bills. And some of them, you know, having to make choices between how they're going to feed their families and how they're going to pay for gas to get to work. Those essential things become a big deal and a big burden.
What have you heard from folks who might be concerned about being permanently laid off? I mean, the Trump administration has not made a secret of wanting to, you know, have a reduction in force. They've riffed a number of people, although there's a lawsuit that at least temporarily has blocked that from happening. What are you hearing from members about that?
Well, some of our members are starting to feel like the administration is not appreciative of what they do. Like they're being targeted, and their livelihoods are being attacked.
Is there chatter among your members about, especially those who are essential workers who are showing up to work and not getting paid for it, about calling in sick or just not really wanting to be there?
Not that I know of. I haven't spoken to anyone that has expressed anything like that. As a union, a federal employee union, we always discourage any type of activity that would even imply that our workforce is not willing to do their duty.
Now, am I right that you yourself are a Border Patrol agent?
That is correct.
So have you been working these last couple of weeks without pay?
Well, I am in a different situation because of the elected position that I am filling currently with the American Federation of Government Employee. I am on leave without pay already.
Okay. I wonder if, in your mind, what's going on right now has the potential to do maybe permanent damage to the workforce of the federal government and maybe make the kinds of jobs that your members do less appealing to people in the future?
I think it's definitely a deterrent for people that are looking into careers within the federal government to know that at some point within any given year, if our Congress fails to fund the country per se, that they could be facing not only furloughs, but also reduction in forces if the administration decides to go that route. So it does create, you know, uncertainty again as to, you know, federal careers and federal jobs.
Do you see any parallels or do you see any lessons that you can learn from the last time the federal government shut down that you can apply to right now?
Well, in my opinion, federal shutdowns are not beneficial for anybody. It's not beneficial for the employees who are not getting paid, whether they're working or being sent home. It's not beneficial for the general public because they're not receiving the services that they should be receiving from our federal agencies. And it's a huge burden on the economy. And so it does definitely cause permanent damage every time that we have to go through one of these government shutdowns.
Do you have any measure of optimism that the government will reopen soon?
Well, I do, or I am optimistic that the government is going to open soon. We just don't know when. So we urge our lawmakers to take action and to come up to an agreement and do their essential duty and fund our government so that we can reopen and service our community once more.
All right. That is Mario Campos, National Vice President of the American Federation of Government Employees. Mario, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The Trump administration admitted this month that its immigration crackdown is hitting farms hard and risking food shortages and higher prices. The warning came buried in a filing to the Federal Registrar, saying the speed and scale of efforts to enforce immigration laws will lead to, quote, significant labor market effects in the agricultural sector, which has long been pushed to depend on a workforce with a high proportion of illegal aliens, unquote. Well, there was a point at which the farming industry wasn't so dependent on illegal workers. In the 1940s and 50s, the Bracero program allowed millions of Mexican men to come to the U.S. legally to work on farms and railroads. But the program ended in the 1960s amid concerns about exploitation and helped spur farm workers to unionize under the late Cesar Chavez. Now, as farmers are worried about letting crops rot in the fields, there's talk of bringing back the Bracero program or something like it. And our next guest says that's an idea that could open a door to abuse. Gustavo Arellano is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and he's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning there, Gustavo. Thanks for coming on.
Gracias for having me.
All right. So I outlined some of the history of the Bracero program there. You have family who are part of it, right?
Oh, yeah. My grandpa from my dad's side, he was a Bracero, and hundreds, if not thousands of men from where my fam, both my mom and my dad are from in Mexico, in Jerez, Zacatecas, went there from the 40s through the 60s. And some of the people you know about and other people, like, I'm just finding out, which it just speaks to how deeply rooted this program was all across rural Mexico during that time.
Yeah. Okay. So you wrote a column recently about a family friend of yours who was part of this program. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Manuel Alvarado comes from a little village, a rancho called La Cañada in Jerez, and a good friend with my dad. I've known him my entire life, but again, until recently, I asked my dad, like, hey, do you know any braceros? Oh, yeah, here, let me call some people. And all of a sudden, Manuel pops up, 85 years old, went to his house in Anaheim, and he told me about the 3 years that he was able to be a bracero from 1961 to 1963 because the program – no, it was 1961 through 1964 because the program ended in 64.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us about his experience, his memories of this. He really seems to remember it like the back of his hand.
Oh, my God. Like, he knew how much they were paying him from Colorado near La Junta down to Del City, Texas, out in Sacramento and Stockton. He remembered the crops and cotton in Texas, melons up in Colorado, which he says were by far the hardest thing to pick because melons have like these little hairs that we like when you go to the supermarket, they don't have the hair anymore. Mm-hmm. Tomatoes in Stockton and all of that. And also he remembered the people who were nice to him, Americans, Japanese Americans. Even the Border Patrol was very polite when they'd go and ask for papers. And he said the meanest people to him by far were Mexican-American contractors, the people who were basically yelling at them and calling them nasty words, forcing them to pick faster and harder.
Right, right. It's interesting because he talks about this almost with a fondness, right, of being a bracero. He says that the program helped a lot of people like him. But then you asked him about the possibility that it could be brought back today in some form or another. And he said, like, immediately, like, not a good idea. Why?
Oh, yeah. I asked him, did you regret being part of this? He's like, nope, no regret. I made my money. It helped other people more than it helped me, but it definitely helped me. And then I said, well, okay, if it was so helpful for people like yourself, do you think it would be good? And he said, no, it makes absolutely no sense. Number one, when you're a bracero, because you already signed a contract, you have no rights whatsoever. So you are left to, you're lucky if you get a good boss, and most likely you're not going to get a good boss. Mm-hmm. And then he looked, what happened was the program ended in 1964. Then he came to this country without papers, eventually became an American citizen through Reagan's amnesty. And so he's looking at all these undocumented people right now who are being subjected to these raids. And he said, it makes no sense to get rid of millions of people and then bring back millions of people under a legal contract. Why don't you just legalize them? They're already here. They already know the work. To bring people up and train them, it's just a giant waste of time and resources. And he's the one who said they'd be treated like slaves. People thought it was me. I'm like, no, this is the bracero who said it himself.
Right, right, right. I thought that was really interesting, that quote. And you asked him about the possibility of Americans replacing these workers, right, being hired to do these kind of farm worker jobs today to fill that need, which is becoming more and more clear, right? Food rotting in the fields. What did he have to say about that idea?
He just doesn't see it. Look, I understand Americans of European descent, especially in rural areas like Nebraska, South Dakota, and other places. And even on, you know, even in Arizona, for that matter, in the smaller towns like Safford, they're used to it. They can do that. But the problem is you would need millions of people to do so. He says that the American mentality, we're talking about the suburban, what we consider now to be the American mentality, is just not cut out for it. It does not want. And this is something that I have been arguing for. I mean, I've been a reporter for 25 years, and I keep telling this. Americans will not do the job that laborers do right now at those wages, not even close. But you go and try to pick strawberries at $100,000 a year, I guarantee you most people would not cut it. My managing editor, Hector Becerra, about 7 years ago, he tried to pick strawberries for 2 days out here in Southern California because mm-hmm. his dad was a strawberry picker. He quit after, like, 5 hours. It was just way too hard. And Manuel, he was very poignant in this, though, because my dad was kind of making, you know, joking about it. It's like, oh, yeah, those Americans, like, they don't want to suffer. And Manuel's like, yeah, they shouldn't suffer. No one should suffer in doing these jobs. But the way American capitalism is, especially with our food market, it's all built on exploitation. There's just no way around it.
That was the most poignant part of this piece that you wrote. And I wanted to ask you about that lastly here. This idea that he says, you know, it's not that they don't want easy work, right? It's that they don't want to suffer. Is that what he thinks it sounds like people are willing to do today? And only some people, it sounds like, are willing to do that, suffer.
Well, look, undocumented people, when they're fleeing situations like what's happening in their home country, they will definitely do that. But you would assume people who have been here multiple generations, the whole idea of the American dream is that you're always improving your lot in life with each passing generation. Who wants to go from, blue collar jobs or white collar jobs in the tech sector, or, again, in suburbia, to go out in the fields and be crouched 8 hours a day, six days a week to do that? In many ways, that seems like not what the United States should be, but it's always been part of this country. And I personally think I wrote a column years ago saying that high school students, at least in California, they should spend that are out in the suburbs. They should spend the summer picking crops just so they know how the other half lives. I guarantee you it would change so many hearts and minds once you start breaking your back over it.
Yeah. All right. We'll have to leave it there for now. That is Gustavo Arellano, a columnist for the Los Angeles Times, joining us to talk about the Bracero program. Thank you so much, Gustavo, for coming back on the show. I really appreciate it.
Gracias.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. This has been the fourth wettest October on record for Phoenix, according to the National Weather Service. And most of that rain has come over the past week or so. Maps maintained by the Maricopa County Flood Control District show some parts of the valley have gotten more than 4 inches of rain over the last 7 days. And with all of that rain, we've seen photos and videos of flooding in parts of the valley, which has led lots of people to ask about flood insurance. With us now for some answers is Lisa Bleiler, Information Outreach and Support Division Manager for the Maricopa County Flood Control District. Lisa, good morning.
Good morning. That's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. You've had a busy week, I'd say, huh?
A little bit. How about that storm? I happen to be in an area that got 4.5 inches of rain.
Oh, my gosh.
In Ahwatukee. So people think it's other places in the county, right here in Metro Phoenix area.
Did you have flooding in your yard?
Not in my yard. I was at the tail end of that microburst. So
okay.
It uprooted some trees behind my condo. And I still have a baseball field 3 feet underwater still
a week later. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So I've got to ask about, we're talking about flood insurance. And I have to say, it sounds kind of counterintuitive, right? That we're living in the desert. We always complain there's not enough rain. There's no large bodies of water immediately nearby. And yet, for so many people, flood insurance is a pretty important thing.
It sure is. And we talk about flood insurance all year long, by the way. But it's real hard when it's hot and dry to say, hey, you really need to think about your risk. And so this is a great opportunity that this is on everyone's mind because we saw what Mother Nature can do. Even when we know the storm is coming, it can be very unpredictable. So what we tell folks is know your risk. Anywhere that it rains here in the valley, that's where you could flood. And so it is that counterintuitive thing. I grew up in Ohio, so you watch the rain come, the creek rises, and it overtops. Now we're flooding. Here, we could be dry for 100 days, get a quarter inch of rain, and have sheet flooding. And it just doesn't make sense to people who haven't been here very long. It's like pouring a bucket of water on the concrete saying, how come it didn't soak in? And so that ground just gets hard, and it has nowhere to go, so it just flows right off. What happened this past week is a little bit more intuitive in that we had sustained rain. It just kept coming, kept coming, kept coming. And that you know, at some point the ground's too wet and can't hold any more water. And so this is just a great time to know your risk. And fortunately for folks in Maricopa County, we provide a lot of resources for that.
It sounds like, and you were as you were describing growing up in Ohio, I grew up on the East Coast, and the same kind of thing, right? Like maybe the reservoir gets too full, or the creek or the stream gets too full. But it seems like a different mindset here, where you're not so much worried about the canal overflowing or something.
Right.
It's literally what's falling from the sky in that moment causing a problem, causing flooding for you.
Yeah, and where it's going. So if you're from other parts of the country, you walk a couple feet down the street, you see a storm drain. You see another one. We have storm drain system here in the metro area, but not that many.
Mm-hmm.
The roads are crowned. We use gravity and we use the geography to our advantage. So it flows down the street into basins in your neighborhood. They look like parks most of the time. Those are built to hold that water all from your neighborhood, collect and let it soak back into the ground. So it's just a different kind of mindset. And when those basins are full, that ground is wet, it has nowhere to go. It just keeps piling up, and it can back up back into your streets and can come towards your home.
You mentioned that anywhere it rains is where you can be at risk. But I wonder if there are parts of the valley that are maybe more prone to flooding than others.
Sure. And the reason we say anywhere it rains, because Mother Nature is unpredictable, right?
Yes.
And we are in a valley. So if you're closer to a mountain and some high ground, and it has, you know, gravity does what gravity does. It comes at you. So folks in the outlying parts of the county, higher elevation, they're going to see more of those things. But again, I was in Ahwatukee, 4.5 inches of rain over 6 days.
Wow.
And so it can happen anywhere. And so some of the things we do at Maricopa County is really help folks know your risk. We're not saying it can rain anywhere. We give you, you can go onto our website and find, are you in a floodplain? FEMA does a good job across the country, but they do large blocks when they figure out what's a floodplain. What Maricopa County residents get, we do studies all across the county. They take a couple years. We go all the way around and come back, and we keep studying because we keep building, keep growing. And so as we do that, we can tell you what's happening not in a 5-mile block, not even a 1-mile block. We can tell you what's happening in your neighborhood.
Mm.
So when we say know your risk, we give you that information. You talked about weather, how much rain we got. We have over 400 rain and stream gauges all across the county. The one by me, I can see 600 feet from my window. But chances are there's one right by you. So we make that available to folks. So when we say, you know, when you're starting to think about your risk, we provide you with a lot of details, a lot of information. And so you're not just taking a shot in the dark.
Understanding that different policies obviously will be different and different people have different needs. In general, like, what does flood insurance cover? Like, why should people have it if it seems like something they need?
Because your regular homeowners or renters policy does not cover flooding. And so if you don't have that special coverage, if any kind of water damages your property, your possessions, anything inside out your home or inside or outside of your home, that's not covered with your homeowners policy. And something really important to understand is if you are going to be getting flood insurance, it takes 30 days for it to go into effect. So if you're seeing that we're going to have another tropical depression come through, when you want to get it, it's too late. So it's really important that it's fresh on everyone's mind. Really start thinking about those opportunities. And Maricopa County gives you lots of information at maricopa.gov/flood insurance. Nice and easy to remember, right?
Yeah, it's too late to be calling to try to set up your policy as you see the dark clouds moving in.
Correct, correct. And so it's just really important to think ahead and think about it now when there isn't that imminent risk.
So do you have a sense? Are there some number of people who you think probably should have flood insurance in the valley that don't?
Again, it's up to what are individual risks at your home. There are things you can do to flood-proof your home. There are things you can do to elevate your property. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say one over the other, but, you know, you don't have to be in a flood zone for it to happen. In fact, 25% of all claims are outside of flood zones.
Really?
Yeah. So
wow.
When I say, and it sounds funny, but anywhere it rains really is a risk.
Yeah, that is interesting. All right. That is Lisa Bleiler, Information Outreach and Support Division Manager with the Maricopa County Flood Control District. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody.
Okay, Mark, did you by any chance watch the hit Netflix show America's Sweethearts, all about the country's most famous NFL cheer squad, the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders?
I missed that one, but I can only imagine how difficult it is what they all do.
Incredible, right? Like serious athletes here. And one of them, one of the major stars of the second season of the show, in fact, is from right here in Arizona. Shawnee Dale is a native of Tucson. She graduated from the University of Arizona, where she was captain of their POM line. And now she's back at her alma mater as their assistant coach. Dale had a six-year career with the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, or DCC, as they're called. She was featured on a CMT show about the team and then stepped into her own as a veteran on season two of America's Sweethearts. And she told me when she put on that uniform, complete with Lucchese cowboy boots and tassels, she felt like a superhero. I spoke with her more about her long career with the Cowboys and the full circle moment she finds herself in now.
It feels pretty surreal, I think, just being able to go from not only U of A as a student and dancer there, going professional and then coming back and just watching the girls and being on the sidelines now. It's almost like I'm a proud mom watching them out there dancing and living their dream. So it is very fulfilling and very surreal to be on this side of it. And I'm just thankful for that opportunity.
Yeah. All right. So we have to talk about America's Sweethearts, this Netflix docuseries that you were a big part of, especially in the second season. I think this show's popularity kind of exceeded all expectations. Like, this turned into a really big hit, and the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, or DCC, you know, turned into something of a national phenomenon there. I wonder, though, like, what it was like to be inside of that experience. Like, did it change life for you in significant ways? Like, was there life before this show and then life after?
Yes, it changed a lot. I feel like I'm really happy that this Netflix show goes beyond training camp and shows like who we are as humans and what we do and what we go through, like not only on the field, but off the field. So life before and after, I guess if I'm trying to like compare it to after filming with CMT and then after Netflix, it has been a little bit crazier. kind of crazy how so many people, I guess, watch the show like and just know you and can look up to you, and you know that you touch someone out there is kind of crazy, but also really rewarding.
Yeah. Yeah. Does that happen to you all the time now? You can't walk around without somebody stopping you?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I'm like, I just think of myself as like this little weird kind of girl who's a little quirky and who danced on a team. And now I'm like, dang, people know like my whole life story.
Yes, kind of crazy. What I liked a lot about this show, Shawnee, was that it does the thing that I really like about a lot of the interviews I get to do, right? Like, it gives you this window into a whole world that I knew nothing about before. Like, this one being cheerleading and dance and DCC and the kind of level of dedication and work and sometimes like bodily injury that goes into it for dancers like yourself. Tell us about that life that you've led. Like, how long have you been dancing?
I've been dancing since I was three, so very long time. I started in ballet, did ballet through my freshman year of high school. Then I switched to like performing and POM and jazz. Yeah, it's been crazy. A lot of back aches, neck aches. I don't know if a lot of people know, but I tore my left labrum my last year. I'm 6 months post-surgery from that. So it's a lot of wear and tear on the body, but just like any other athlete, I feel like you're kind of like okay doing it because you're like, this is my dream, and you know that it has like an expiration date. So you're like, I'm just pushed through because this is the thing that I've worked my whole life for and I love it. And no matter how bad it hurts, like I'm going to go out there and smile because someone else, like there are hundreds of girls waiting to take my spot. And like, I just want to soak up one more time.
Yeah. Yeah. Why did you want to become a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader? You said this was your dream, and the show really makes it seem like this particular cheer team for the Dallas Cowboys is like the mecca of cheer teams, right?
Oh, yeah. So I guess when I first started getting into like POM and like the cool football side of it, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was like, I guess I could go professional, like maybe whatever. And a recruiter actually from DCC like reached out to my college coach at U of A and asked if I wanted to try out. And I was like, maybe. Like, it just felt like such a dream. Like, DCC was top tier, and you're like, I don't know, like, do I want to go and like try and put myself through that? Like, I've seen the CMT show. It's kind of crazy. I was like, you know what? It's going to be now or never. Like, I'm going to regret it if I don't try out. So I was like, let me just try out. Let me go all in. And I just kept making it round after round. And then next thing I know, I was like in training camp, moving to Texas, and I made the team. So it was pretty crazy. It was just kind of like, whoa.
Yeah. Let me ask you about this point in your life now, because one of the things that I think is interesting when I've ever interviewed dancers, but athletes, you know, performers in this way who use their bodies, who's, you know, like work is their body, that there's sort of an expiration date. I mean, how old are you now? And you're kind of you're retired in a way.
Yeah, I know. I just turned 29 and already had surgery and I'm retired. It's kind of crazy to think about it, but also I'm like, well, my body was put through it. Like, I was thinking at PT the other day, just from all the games, like nothing else, no other appearance or Christmas shows, I've done Thunder 60 times. So I'm like, that's a lot to put your body through.
That's the most famous dance from the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, where it ends in this crazy split too, right?
The crazy jump split, which I'm like so thankful I could do it. But I'm like, okay, I'm happy to say I can retire, and I used to do that, and now it's someone else's turn and I can watch them shine.
So it sounds like you're transitioning well to the new role that you've taken on as an assistant coach, and to sort of, like you said, watching from the sidelines. How do you view the rest of your career? Do you want to stay in the coaching realm? Do you feel like that's rewarding in a way?
Yes, I would love to stay in the coaching realm. I know, even looking up to the head coach now, who was my coach in pageants and for Palmline, like watching her blossom into this amazing coach, like I want to be that. I want to be her one day, and like I strive to be half the woman that she is. So it's rewarding just being able to learn from her as well.
Yeah. I wonder, part of the thing with athletes, right, is that you're kind of chasing a high all the time, right? After that, like you're used to this high level of performance and pressure and, you know, adrenaline. Do you miss that, or are you glad to say goodbye to it?
I do miss it a little bit, but also, like, I just remember the first game back I was on the sidelines watching as a coach for U of A. I was like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. Like, I miss the college atmosphere. I miss like how the whole community gets together and like cheers on the Arizona Wildcats.
Yeah.
And so that gave me like a different bit of adrenaline. And I'm like, okay, I want it for these girls. I want it for the team. Like, I want it for them. And so I think it's a little bit different. So like, I'll always miss the dance side of all that, but I feel like I get it now.
Yeah.
From being a coach.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear you've struck that happy medium well. That is Shondi Dale joining us, former Dallas Cowboys cheerleader and the new assistant coach at the University of Arizona. Shondi, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.